This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad. Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to another edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Not now, Elwood. I'm making custard. It was your favorite as a child.
And this is episode 28. On tonight's show, we are going to be looking at Fringe, as well as taking a look at British public safety films as we look at the film Apache. But before we obviously get into all that, it's a custom as always to ask what you've been watching. So, I mean, Lucky, I mean, since the last show, what has sort of been holding your interest?
Something happened that I didn't really expect to happen. The BBC decided they were going to release Doctor Who, the classic Doctor Who episodes, in Blu-ray box sets. Now, they had already done a couple. They did the TV movie, the 96 TV movie, on Blu-ray as an individual Blu-ray. And they did, I think, the first John Pertwee story, Spearhead in Space. I think for some reason, some goofy esoteric reason, that was done entirely on film instead of a combination of film and video. So they were able to put that on Blu-ray and actually have it benefit from the high def without actually having to do anything of it. But this is a new thing where they have upscaled all. They took the first Tom Baker season, the one with Ark in Space and Genesis of the Daleks, and they upscaled it, and they took all the special features, the featurettes that were on the original DVDs, and they made some new ones, and they released them on a DVD box set. So I've been revisiting Tom Baker's first season of Doctor Who, and it's just as glorious as I remember it.
I'm just about to say, I mean, while I'm not obviously the same level of Whovian as yourself, I mean, Tom Baker is, I think he's really such an accessible doctor, and I think it's unsurprising why he's a favourite amongst the Whovians. I mean, it was between him and Sylvester McCoy was like the main brunt of my Doctor Who episodes that I came up with. They always seem to be the two doctors that they play a lot of their episodes of. And yeah, there's something about Tom Baker. I think Tom Baker's nuts already, so he's sort of perfect to play a character like the Doctor. So
yeah, there's just something where, you know, I mean, as much as I like some of the other actors, it's like, you know, Patrick Troughton, for example. I think Patrick Troughton was a magnificent character actor, but it's just, I think one of the glorious things about Tom Baker's run as Doctor Who is that you don't get the feeling you're watching an actor. You get the feeling that you're just watching Tom Baker just be his general eccentric self. And that's just, I mean, I do have, as you noticed, kind of like a slight obsession with Doctor Who to the point where I've actually gone and I've watched other movies with Tom Baker in them, like Nicholas and Alexandra and The Freak Maker and I think Vault of Terror. And he pretty much just plays every character like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I watched Nicholas and Alexandra where he played Rasputin. I kept expecting him to... I kept expecting him to offer the Tsar a jelly baby. It was just absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, I'm just about to say, whenever I see Tom Baker, it's sort of like, it just makes you think that they missed a trick. It's sort of like, oh, the Tom Baker era worked. How about we try that again, and they just bring in Brian Blessed? That's what dead, I kind of want to say.
Dead ringers, you know. I'm Brian Blessed. And there was, in fact, pretty much, if I remember correctly, just about every time, yeah, really starting with Tom Baker leaving, every time a new doctor would come up on the old show, the number one, they would always, you know, pull people to say who should play the doctor next. And if they would either always come up with either Brian Blessed or Margaret Thatcher, I guess. Because I guess if there was really one thing you wanted to throw at the Daleks, it was, I guess, somebody who would put their miners out of work and destroy their economy. That and really not a whole lot else. I discovered this Canadian, it's my current fluff. I discovered this Canadian show called Private Eyes, okay, which stars Jason Priestley from 90210 as a retired hockey star who's joined up with a private investigator as a partner at her private investigations firm. So it's a very fluffy show with a lot of, got this very sort of modern Moonlighting vibe, a lot of will they or won't they, and you know, it's pure fluff, but it you know, it keeps me from gnawing my own limbs off instead of having to sit through another. I mean, my mother isn't doing well, and I go over and I spend a lot of time with her just keeping her company, and she likes this show, and I, you know, all I have to do is just hope that it's a show she wants to watch today, because I'm just really, really, really out of patience with having watched episodes of old, either old Western shows like Gunsmoke or, God, I think I have to see, if I have to sit through another episode of NCIS LA, I'm just gonna, I think, eat my own foot.
Yeah, NCIS LA, it's not the best. We had such high hopes when it started, because when you look at the cast there, it was another great cast that they had assembled for LA. But for some reason, it just never, I don't know, it just never sort of took hold. I mean, for myself, I mean, I've always been like, mainly a fan of like Special Victims Unit, and now that's kind of going down the pan. I've been going back and watching like the old episodes of like the original Law and Order and Criminal Intent, which Criminal Intent in particular is interesting, but it seems to have this obsession with constantly having a quirky male detective.
Oh yeah.
And Jeff Goldblum puts in some time on the last few seasons, which was pretty
really
cool.
Just about any show. I that's kind of what I liked, you know, because D'Onofrio, I guess, decided he wasn't up to doing like a full order, so they would alternate between him and someone else. And I thought that was really, really interesting when they were alternating between him and Chris Knopf, who they brought back as Mike Logan, who he had played in the very early days of original Recipe Law and Order, you know, back when Michael Moriarty was still on the show. That's really interesting, because I think Mike Logan is a very, very, very different contrast from Bobby Gorin. And then I guess they just stopped doing that and brought in Jeff Goldblum. And I'm just like, so okay. All right. So it's quirky. It's quirky guy who holds his head to the side time again. All right. Let's do this.
That's cool.
What about you?
Yeah, I mean, for myself, I mean, it's been a pretty slim sort of month. First of all, I mean, we just might as well get out of the way and talk about Westworld. Westworld has now come to an end for its second season. And yeah, I'm very concerned where Westworld is heading right now. And I think I might be the only one, but at the moment, it seems to be heading down that path that Lost was, where it's trying to be clever and it doesn't seem to know why it's going the direction it's going. So at the moment, it's the season two is focused on the android uprising, so to speak, and we got to see other parks within this version of Westworld. So we got to see Raj World, and we got to see Samurai World, and it's been certainly interesting, but at the same time, there's been a lot of bump and attempts to create this sort of like highbrow sort of sci-fi thinking in terms of the purpose of these androids and what certain members amongst their number want, that has made me a little concerned where they're going to go, and especially where season two ends. It makes me wonder where they're actually going to go, and just really, there's just a lot of potential issues that I can see going forward. I mean, we haven't got a release date for season three yet. I'm expecting, if it's anything like season two, that it's going to be at least a year's wait, because it costs a lot to make the show, and it hasn't really got the same sort of numbers as Game of Thrones, where they're sort of rushing to throw money at it.
And it's also got, I think, something of an unusually prestigious cast, where they've got to work this around. Like, I know Anthony Hopkins and Jeffrey Wright are on it.
Yes.
And they've got to work around their schedules. And I know there's like a couple of others. I don't know if they're still on. Is Evan Rachel Wood still on?
Yeah, she's still there. And I mean, she, if I'm remembering right, she plays Dolores, who's like one of the first hosts. And
right.
She sort of like heads up the rebellion of these androids to speak to. And at the same time, you've got different hosts that have got different abilities and are certainly on their own sort of unique paths, because they view these changes happening around them in different ways. And I mean, I felt really sorry for Jonathan Bonneman, who at our home base, thatmomentin.com, has been doing the weekly write-ups for Westworld, because a lot of times an episode will finish it and I'd be like, I have no clue what actually happened in this episode. And it's been one of those shows where I've actually watched the talking point show that's afterwards, which in the UK has been Westworld. And it's been kind of reassuring to know that when they've had the guests on, they've had no clue what's supposed to be going on either. But there seems to be this general opinion that people are sort of buying into it, to being that, oh, it's wonderfully weird. It's like Lynch's Twin Peaks. And it's like, we don't need to make Westworld like Twin Peaks. I mean, Twin Peaks is its own thing. It's weird because it's Lynch heading it up. I mean, just because he can make weirdness work doesn't mean that every show now has to be overly complex and confusing the way that this second season's been.
The thing that has really kind of been getting me, that's been standing in my way of wanting more to see Westworld, why I haven't really gone and committed myself to going and actually, you know, watching it, is this general feeling. And you hit the nail on the head when you talked about Lost. The idea, because I know some of the stuff that they're doing in season two is, I know a few of the things that they're doing in season two, like they're doing with the multiple timelines, and you're not really sure when these sort of things fit together. And it really, it almost seems like the people that are putting it, the people that are running the show, are deliberately kind of constructing it in a way to kind of like cater to the sort of fans that want to come up with crazy fan theories and are convinced that, you know, the sort of people that are convinced that, you know, Tyrion Lannister is secretly a Targaryen and all that.
Yeah.
And it's less of a narrative and more of a puzzle.
Oh, definitely. And it seems that
ever since Lost, and I'm not, I will go to bat for the last few seasons of Lost. I know a lot of people, I know that they got a lot of guff for how Lost ended and for that last season. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed that final episode. I kind of liked what they did. I like the reveal of what was going on. It's not how I would have done the Flash sideways, but on the other hand, it's very much like they were just kind of you know, I'm not going to criticize showrunners for making stuff up as they go along, because you kind of got to do that with any show. But the thing is that they were just so transparent about it. You knew that there was stuff that you really wanted to know that you were never going to find out. You know, that and that was, I think, the gigantic problem. You know, and I see so much of that in Westworld, where, like I said, it's less of like a narrative to be enjoyed and more of a puzzle to be solved. And right now, that is just really not what I want from a TV show. That is the sort of thing I have been attracted to in the past at various points. It's not where I am right now. It's really kind of. And the other thing is that with such a huge cast, there just seems to be so many things going on. It just seems to be hard. And that's like the HBO thing. That was a problem with, or I shouldn't say it was a problem, because I actually, one of the things I loved about Deadwood was that probably about six episodes into Deadwood, I just really stopped actually even paying attention or caring to who was doing what to whom. And just basically just sat there and watched people act at each other, which was glorious. You know, you'd go and you'd have this wonderful scene where Ian McShane, you know, spewed forth this gout, practically Shakespearean gout of profanity at William Sanderson or Jeffrey Wright or Powers Booth. And I couldn't tell you a thing, one, that happened, like, outside, like, the first season of Deadwood. Other than that, Ian McShane swore at somebody, and then there was an argument between Timothy Oliphant and John Hawkes. And that's what I was watching Deadwood for. You know, the same problem. Game of Thrones has the same problem, and I think the only reason I'm able to track Game of Thrones so well is because I've read the books. This seems like it's going to be a problem with Westworld as well.
Yeah, I mean, with Game of Thrones, it all sort of comes together. Yes, it's confusing for like half a season, then you see how it all sort of comes together. Same with like things like Breaking Bad. The problem with Westworld has been not so much the timelines, which I mean, at one point I think they're charging like 14 different timelines this thing runs on. But more the character motivations. It's like, why are these characters doing this? Why are they suddenly able to do these things? And it just feels like very sort of complicated. And now, obviously, with season two, we've got this whole storyline where we're moving out of the park. And it's kind of thinking, well, if we're moving out of the park, we've still got these six other parks you haven't revealed. And the writers are like, oh, yeah, we're going to reveal what these other parks are. I'm really hoping Dino Land is one of them.
I don't really think you could get a good... I don't think you could really get a good impression narrative out of Dino World. And anyway, Dino World would, of course, be called Jurassic Park.
Yeah, I just love the idea of, like, it's like we go into this world, and it's like, oh, what's in this world? And it's like suddenly a huge T-Rex appears from the bushes. So, like, yeah, I'm sold on that. But it's sort of like we've got characters who are now leaving the park and entering into the real world, which essentially eliminates the need for us to be in the park. And it makes it very difficult for us to still have events which are happening in these other parks, especially when the whole focus now seems to be on these characters who have now escaped the park and are now potentially looking to blend in with human society. I wish there was more clarity on why characters are suddenly able to do certain things, why they are motivated this way, and a lot of it's just getting lost in the overly complex plotting of the shows. But I know, like you said, there's probably people out there who are absolutely having an absolute joy, you know, just having a real kick out of putting their little fan theories together. But for myself, it's season two, while it certainly had its moments and it was unquestionably enjoyable to get through, just makes me very concerned that we're going to end up viewing this as another Lost once we get into season three, once those numbers start dropping off and it becomes much more of a cult item than it currently is. Right. But that's just my theory I'm going to throw out there for the minute, and And if people obviously feel free to let us know what your thoughts on Westworld are, or any of the shows we discussed, you know, in the comments section, or if you want to let us know on Facebook or Twitter, those means are open. You, of course, if you haven't done already, please do hit those subscribe buttons or like buttons if you listen to us on iTunes or through our home base, thatmomentin.com. You can show your support in through either of those options. On the more lighter end of things, I've been rewatching last year's King of the Road, because the new King of the Road starts on Viceland next week. If you're unfamiliar with King of the Road, we have talked about it on the show previously. It's a skating competition slash scavenger hunt held by Thrasher magazine, where they have three teams of skaters go across America, and they have to complete challenges, be it tricks or sort of dares, such as like making out. They have one with a making out contest. They have to do like challenges with different skaters that they meet along the way. It's a really, really fun competition, and there's some really fantastic skating. I mean, this last competition we had skaters from Creature, Enjoy, and Deathwish, and every year the bar seems to constantly be put up. And as someone, I mean, I started off writing for skateboarding magazines. I wrote for Kingpin, so this is part of me that kind of wishes I could like go and do, you know, document the King of the Road tournament. And then part of me realizes, you know, I'm not the young, hungry writer I was 18 years ago, who was happy to sleep in the dirt and work for food. And you know, you're 35. Those you need sleep in a comfy bed. You don't want to be hanging around in a van for 2 weeks with people who aren't washing, and just in close proximity with people for 2 weeks, and doing, being forced to do God knows what to points. But it does also make me wish that all the little podcast teams lived a lot closer, so we had like ourselves here at That Moment In. We lived a little closer to, you know, like the French Toast Sunday guys or the Kissing Contest guys, and that way we could hold our own scavenger hunts.
Yeah.
Hold our own danger hunt, like fight with a hobo or get a bullet from a cadaver or something. I don't know, just fun little things to run around a town and do. Just like each year we'll pick a different city and like be like, year one, we're gonna go to Chicago, or we're gonna go to Baltimore. It just it's, you know, it just the sad thing. I mean, obviously while we feel connected via the internet, we do obviously have this realization that, you know, we have a few thousand miles between each of the members here, because we're all scattered about the place, and
yeah,
even though the internet brings us across. But no, if you like skateboarding, or you just like Jack Castell antics, then King of the Road's worth watching. I've also been rewatching Ink Master. We just wrapped up season 10. I don't know if you watched that one, Lackey, or you have any interest in tattoos.
Ink Master, is that, oh god, that's the tattoo competition?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it started off as, you know, just another competition like America's Next Top Model or Project Runway, but for tattoo artists, and it's now evolved into, like, this heavyweight title for tattoo artists to have. So every year the competition gets a lot more fierce, and it's a really fantastic show. Even if you don't know anything about tattooing, it's presented much like American Next Top Model and Project Runway, in the fact that you can know nothing about the subject matter, but it explains it, so you learn what a good tattoo is, what different styles of tattooing are. And they've got a really great panel. They've got Chris Novak, who's a Japanese traditional tattooist, and you've got Oliver James, I think it is, who's American traditional.
This is the one that Dave Navarro is on, right?
He is.
Dave Navarro of Jane's Addiction.
Yeah, he's okay. I mean, he was originally brought on because, I mean, he's the main host,
right?
But his original purpose, he explains, is that he's represents the client's perspective on the judging panel, and because he's been getting tattooed for years, so he's knowledgeable. But you can tell as the season has gone on, he's obviously been paying attention to what these really top artists have been saying, because he really gives some really insightful input. He's able to recognize different aspects of tattooing, and really works well with Oliver Peck and Chris Nunes, who are obviously the tattoo masters. But yeah, it's a really great series. I mean, it's just a fun disposable competition, as in watching, not so much the competition. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the next season because it's they bring back all the masters, so everyone who's won up to this point, and having them battle against each other for the ultimate master, which is going to be really interesting to see. So,
cool.
But yeah, that's about it for what we've been watching. I do want to obviously do a shout out to the Bad Reception podcast, because, you know, while we obviously like to promote our own things here on thatmomentin.com, you know, I'd like to think that the podcasting community is just that. It's a community. You know, you don't just listen to one podcast. And the Bad Reception guys, they are also a cult TV podcast. I mean, they've, looking at the shows they've done, it gives me a lot of inspiration for things that we look, because they've looked at things like Ghost Whisperer and Captain Bucky O'Hare, Manimal. They seem to have...
Oh my god, Manimal.
And they've also looked at Erie, Indiana as well, which is how I first heard about their podcast. And in particular, they did one where they were being introduced to wrestling. And it's such a great episode because obviously they have no clue about WWE and wrestling, and just how respectful they are of the material. It's not like, oh, it's wrestling.
Right.
And just the general approach to how they view cult TV. I mean, they're in the new position because obviously they record in their home studio, unlike ourselves who have to battle with Skype and studio cats and all these other fun things that we work with, conditions we work under. So they watch a show and then they talk about it afterwards. So like Blade Licking Thieves, they talk about it from a very fresh perspective.
It's the way I appeared on it. What's it? Clint's podcast. Alcohollywood's done the same thing. Yeah, Alcohollywood does the same thing, yeah. I've been on that a couple times, gone over to Clint's apartment, watched the movie with Clint and Jared and the other guests, and then they would, you know, get out the mixing board and the microphones, and we'd all talk about it.
Yeah, I've heard he hosts people. So you go around and you get to have a drink, which is nice.
Yeah, yeah. Jared, I think Jared even specifically comes up with the drink. I don't know. One of them is actually, from what I understand, I can't remember whether it's Clint or Jared, is a fairly, if I remember correctly, fairly accomplished mixologist.
Yeah. So yeah, you definitely got some extra podcast viewing there. I mean, check them out. Bad Reception, who are available, you know, iTunes, Podomatic, everywhere good podcast fan, and Alcoholywood, who I constantly hear recommendations for. So definitely give those guys a listen as well.
And definitely, if you're interested, to put one more plug in on Clint's for Clint here. If you're a fan of Alcoholywood, Clint Worthington also does a podcast with Nathan Rabin, formerly of the AV Club, called the Nathan, I think it's called the Nathan Rabin Happy Cast. So I personally think it should be called the Nathan Rabin and Clint Worthington Happy Cast, but what do I know?
Yeah, so.
Very little, apparently.
Okay. Also, well, we're obviously still plugging. If you obviously enjoy, our opening theme is by Fuzzy Machete, and we obviously got the word today that they have got a new track out,
awesome.
Which you can definitely check out. This one's about Lego.
of course it is.
Because, you know, they talk about how much they love TV shows when they did our opening, and now it's the new track's called Unspecified Plastic Interlocking Toy Bricks. Which we will put the link up as well, but you can also find the link on Cinema Recall's Facebook page as well, because yeah, it's because Cinema Recall host Ben does also serve as our announcer as well, so thank you to those guys.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, they're Fuzzy Machete. They're an indie rock punk band. I think they're out of St. Paul. I have some, other than Vern, I have some friends in St. Paul, and I would love to get up to the Twin, or not in, in St. Paul, but they're in the Twin Cities area. And I would, you know, sometime when I'm up there, I would love to catch them and go and say hi. So
I would love to see how that conversation goes. It's like,
I would love to see how it goes too. I have no idea who they are. I just know that they do our theme.
Yeah. It's like,
and they're friends of Vern. I think some of them, I think they may, I know Vern's a drummer as well as on top of his other many manifold talents. As I know, he plays with some punk and indie bands up in the Twin Cities. yeah. Minneapolis and St. Paul. I think he's played with some of them.
Over at Cinema Recall, they have just launched that. Ben has just launched his Patreon campaign. So if you want to get some bonus episodes, you can throw him some bucks and for his Patreon campaign. And I think from what I believe, he has got some exciting projects lined up there for Patreon subscribers. So definitely check him out at Cinema Recall. Part of the That Moment in Podcast Network. And while we're obviously talking about thatmomentin.com, and who are not only, you know, supply the network we're proud members of, they also have some great stuff happening on the site. I mean, Zoe Rose Smith has now joined the ranks of the great Unwashed writers and is currently writing about some truly disturbing cinema, including Neku Dharma. And she touched on a Serbian movie. But, I mean, anyone who's familiar with Zoe's work would know that she's always finding some dark aspect of cinema to write about, so it's great to see her bringing it up.
I don't believe I'm familiar with her work, but Godspeed to her, and it does sound like she's going down getting some truly sick shit. So,
because she's obviously got her sight Zobo with a shotgun.
Okay, that's who we're talking about. Okay, all right, now I know who we're talking about.
Yeah, she's got her own site, Zobo with a Shotgun, and she's now writing stuff for That Moment in as well. So it's great. The site's continuing to grow. We've got exciting projects happening. So
I ought to see if I could get something of like a writing gig for That Moment in or That Moment on. Especially, I think if I can actually like get the name of the site right, that would always help. I think
always helps warm you to your editor.
I don't know that time when. I think we're dedicated to the flashbacks on. I think we're like entirely about flashbacks on Family Guy, something like that. You know.
Cool. On to the first of our selections this evening. We're going to talk about Fringe season 2 episode 1. Now, Lucky, I mean, this was obviously your pick because it features a current actress who's been kidnapped by a monarchy who previously appeared in this season, and that was about it.
It was hilarious because when I first, it's like, oh yeah, that Prince Harry's dating an American actress. It's like, who is it? Meghan Markle? What? Amy Jessup? I guess she had also been on Suits. I guess it's the thing she's mainly known for. But yeah, so the name of the episode, I think it's called A New Day in the Old Town. It's the second season premiere. For Fringe, and Fringe is kind of Fringe, for those people who don't remember Fringe or don't know Fringe, Fringe was kind of like a, it started off, it's a J.J. Abrams show, and it premiered on Fox over here, I think it premiered in 2008. And the first season, the basic premise of it, it follows the Department of Homeland Security, so-called Fringe Division, which is basically kind of like an X-Files unit. There's even a couple of X-Files references in the episode. There's even, if you may have even noticed, there's one point where you even see somebody watching an episode of the X-Files. So yes, Mulder and Scully make a cameo. At another point, they talk about X cases. The first season of the show focused on what was called the pattern, which was this idea that there were science was kind of getting to a point where, you know, weird stuff would happen. We really didn't know. Science was kind of getting out of science had kind of progressed beyond our ability to control. So the point of Fringe Division, which was led by a guy named Philip Broyles, who's played by Lance Reddick from Oz. The three main people are Olivia Dunham, who's played by an Australian actress named Olivia Anna Torv, who I believe is now on Mindhunter. And then two civilian contractors, a kooky fringe scientist by the name of Walter Bishop, played by John Noble, who at that point was mainly known for setting himself on fire while Billy Boyd sang to him. In the Lord of the Rings movies, he was Denethor, he plays a genius scientist who took a little bit too much acid and kind of went kind of like he became the Sid Barrett of science, and spent some time at a mental institution, was able to. He's now consulting with the FBI with his son Peter, who's played by Joshua Jackson Pacey what was the name of that show?
Dawson's Creek.
Dawson's Creek. Yeah, sorry. And then there's like a couple of other characters. There's Blair Brown, who plays this secretary and personal assistant of this shadowy scientist named William Bell, who we will meet later on in the season, played by he's not in this episode, we're not going to get into him too much. And then there's a junior agent, and played by Jessica Nicole, the I think she's the old woman who lives in the house in on Night Vale. And then another odds guy, Kirk Acevedo, plays another FBI agent. And basically they go around and they investigate these weird things happening. And so at the end of season one, they kind of started to get more into starting to build this mythology that was kind of separate from the idea of corporate shenanigans and conspiracies and X-Files type stuff. And they started to kind of get this mythology going about an alternate universe where there was like this absolutely bizarre technology, which we start seeing more and more throughout the series. We see two examples in this, which I'll get into in a moment. And in the finale, the first season finale, Olivia had gone to the other side, talked to William Bell, but she disappeared from our world. And so she kind of comes back. In this one, they start off by everybody is investigating a bizarre car crash. And then all of a sudden, Olivia comes crashing through the window of an empty car. This is where we really start kind of getting with the fringe mythology in earnest. This is the episode. It introduces the shapeshifters. Who are these sort of like genetically engineered super soldiers who can steal other people's forms by killing them and getting this device, and then which connects two people, which you take like a plug that looks kind of like a, I guess like one of your, not an American, but like a British power plug.
Yeah.
Except with like nails instead of plugs, and you stick it in your corpse's soft palate, and you stick it in your soft palate, and you press a button, and you can turn into this other person. And then there's another one of my favorite things, which is the typewriter that can type, the typewriter that you can use between dimensions. That you can type on it in one hand, and then there's a mirror effect next to it, and then you can see the letters go down pressing it while you don't see who's pressing the button, the keys. You know, it autonomously comes up and gives you your orders. And you see all sorts of bizarre stuff like that in Fringe. So they start talking more about the alternate universe here. And it also, this episode also kind of starts to imply a few things. One of the things that's kind of like a throwaway joke throughout the episode is that Peter's birthday is coming up and Walter wants to make him custard for his birthday, even though Peter insists he hates it, but Walter says, no, it's your favorite thing. It was your favorite as a child. And we're going to now, how far, I know that I kind of like inspired in you like a desire to watch Fringe. So how far did you get?
I finally dug out season one.
Okay.
So I'm right back at the beginning, and I'm only about four episodes in, because Fringe is a show that requires a certain amount of attention to it, because it is a little heavier than X-Files. A lot of people sort of saw it as being this big X-Files rip, and it's really not, because yes, while there are similarities, I mean, obviously here in the X-Files we have FBI, here we have the... Interpol, was it?
I believe it's the so-called Fringe division of the Department of Homeland Security, which was it's basically a cabinet position that was formed after 9/11.
So
counterterrorism.
Yeah. So well, obviously the X-Files was all about conspiracy and aliens and mutants and all that good stuff. Fringe was about fringe technology and fringe sciences. So while we occasionally had like the Monster of the Week, It was more sort of like, oh, what if we had a device that allowed us, for example, to go between two dimensions, or like it to create a portal, which is a really good episode in this first season where they find a pair of legs in the park, and they find out it's a teleporting device, and the guy had apparently just not got through it in enough time, so being cut in half.
Right.
Now, obviously, we're in season two. We've got lots of elements that are going on in this show, because obviously, as the show goes on, it becomes more focused on its multiverse. And this was one of the shows which managed to do a multiverse theory and make it actually work well. There was a very clear definition between the two worlds, and it was very easy to follow the different worlds, which has always been a sticking point whenever shows have tried to do alternate timelines and alternate dimensions.
Series 6 of Doctor Who, the one that introduces every time, pretty much every single episode reboots Amy Pond, so I have no idea who she is anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, this week Amy Pond's a model. No, this time she's a journalist. Now she's a novelist, and I'm like, make up your fucking mind.
Yeah, at least they knew what they wanted. And it was some great ideas. I mean, with season two, obviously, as you said, we're introduced to the shapeshifters, who are just downright creepy, because they basically, as part of the face mode, we see at the beginning this guy who's escaping from the cops. He basically smushes his face together before he turns on this device, and then he becomes this guy he's killed. But you see him like press his nose and he adjusts his cheek, and his face is basically like a big wad of silly putty. He's just able to mold it to what he needs it to be. And it does unfortunately mean that we do get the sticking point at the end of the episode where he's changed his form again, and it's done a lot quicker than it seems to be. The process seems to be at the start, because at the start it seems to be this long drawn out process, and by the end of the episode it seems like, oh, we can do this real quick, we don't need to go for all these steps. We also have these bald headed guys called the Watchers, I believe.
The Observers,
sorry. Who basically observe mankind, and they're sort of noteworthy because they like really spicy food. So they'd be constantly shown like having sandwiches, and they put like loads of pepper and loads of hot sauce on and just eat it like it's nothing. And they're constantly like making notes, and it was great in the fact that the show found a way to work them into it. It found a way to work elements of the two, as I said already, the two dimensions, so that if you do something in dimension A, it's going to have a knock-on effect to dimension B. And there was this, obviously, a key character who had been borrowed from one dimension and put into the other that really became a key aspect to the later seasons, which I thought was just so clever. And, I mean, J.J. Abrams at this point, I mean, this is his third crack at TV. He did Alias, which is fantastic. He did Lost.
It's his fourth. Felicity was his first.
I always forget Felicity.
Because Alias was basically the log line for Alias. What he used, the pitch for Alias, was what if Felicity was a spy?
You're right. I mean, Alias was obviously how I got introduced to him. And I mean, Alias I started watching because Quentin Tarantino turned up as a bad guy.
It just had the best casting on Alias. You would watch a show, you would watch an episode, you'd never kind of expect it, but Quentin Tarantino would show up, or Angus Scrimm, or David Cronenberg would show up. Yeah. And it was just that was the great thing about, I mean, Alias, I think, kind of just morphed into so much nonsense pretty early, but I just loved basically watching it for what weirdo was, or not what weirdo, but who J.J. Abrams is going to pull out of the woodwork next.
I loved Alias. I mean, Alias was one of the first shows I actually bought the box sets for, mainly because the scheduling gods screwed it up pretty royally. So we got like the first season on Channel 4, and then it got lost somewhere on the satellite channels I didn't have. So I was buying the box sets as they were coming out, and this was the only show I bought box sets for at the time, and I love Alias. And then obviously Lost was his sort of follow-up, and that was diversive. And then he does Fringe, which is again, it's very cult is the best way to describe Fringe. I think it got discovered more through word of mouth than than a sort of like this show, like the, this sort of like hit show much that the X-Files was.
I actually got turned on to Fringe, and I'm not going to say how, but I got turned on to Fringe before it premiered, let's say.
Okay.
And say no, we'll say no more on the subject. I got turned on to it before it actually premiered and before it was being broadcast weekly. So I was on board with Fringe since the beginning. And basically what had happened is I think they had scheduled it on a night where they had scheduled it on a night where it was doing very well for the first season. It was doing very well. And then what they did was for the second season, Fox moved it to, if I recall correctly, Thursday 9 p.m. Eastern slot, which is the most, at the time, the most competitive time slot on American TV, because it was running up against, if I recall correctly, it was running up against the Shondaland shows. It was running up against Grey's Anatomy and Private Practice. And it was also running against, I think, American Idol. And it was basically it was put in that position, and it stayed there, and it basically, the ratings tanked. They stayed in that position for all of season two and half of season three. And at the beginning, after the mid-season break in season three, they moved it to Friday, which at the time was basically considered to be the death slot. There are people, I was actually surprised that Fringe was renewed for its third season, and there was even kind of a joke that they kind of knew this was coming, the producers knew was that this was coming, because they actually named the mid-season premiere, the first one that was a premiere that was airing on Friday, Firefly was the name of the episode. So, three guesses as to what that's a reference to. And again, remember that Fringe was airing on Fox. So the fact that Fringe actually managed to, you know, stay on for another 2.5 seasons is really nothing short of miraculous. But it was when it moved to Thursdays, It never, because there was just, CSI was the other show it was running against. And that was when CSI was at the top of the ratings game.
Yeah.
That was, CSI was like, I think, the top rated American scripted show at the time. And it was just, it was running against that and Grey's. And it was just, like I said, the ratings never recovered. On the other hand, it gave the creative team, Joel Wyman and Jeff Pinkner, I think one of the things that that's great when you basically have no audience is you can get away with some amazing stuff. So some of the weirder, more experimental stuff, I don't think they would have been able to do certain things like the tradition was always starting with this was, again, you have to kind of remember this is in the early part of the decade. Later on in the season, Fox, this was, I think, the first season for Glee, and Glee had become a big kind of massive zeitgeist phenomenon. So Fox decreed that all of their shows would have a musical episode, and Fringe ended up doing a musical episode that was episode 19 in the running order. So from this point on, there's a tradition that the 19th episode of every season of Fringe will somehow be like experimental or just out there in nature. Like in season three, it's an animated episode. In season four, it's a flash forward episode that takes place like 50 years in the future that actually ends up setting up the final season. So in many ways, I think they were able. I think they were able to. A lot of the stuff that they did with Fringe that was so interesting, it made it so exciting to watch because you really didn't know what you were going to get from week to week. And they were getting away with stuff, you know, stuff in terms of gore, stuff in terms of violence, stuff in terms of drug references. You know, Walter is a heavy drug user, and they don't tiptoe around it. I don't think they would have been able to do that in their original time slot, or if they'd somehow managed to stick in, you know, if they'd managed to build an audience, to carve an audience up out of the Thursday night time slot. I don't think they would have been able to do stuff like that with more people watching.
Yeah, I mean, the character of Walter is really interesting. I mean, it's a real credit to John Noble, because obviously the Walter we know is, as you said, he's the typical mad scientist. He's kind of like Rick from Rick and Morty, but, you know, with a conscience. And as you said, he's a self-prescribing drug user who spent time in a mental hospital. And it's really great when we find out why he is the way he is. And at the same time, when we see the alternate version of Walter.
Walternate.
Yeah, who's a much more darker character. It's really interesting to see him obviously play the two sides of this character. Obviously, Olivia, our agent, as you said, she's played by Anna Tov, who's this otherworldly presence to begin with. So she's perfectly cast in this world where you're never sure what's supposed to be going on, to have this like otherworldly being like Anna Tov as your female lead agent is just absolutely perfect casting. And obviously Joshua Jackson there is sort of like the glue which holds it all together.
I want to interrupt you here and say something really quick about Anna Torv as the character of Olivia, where, as you said, later on in Fringe, we're going to introduce all these alternate universe versions of these characters.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing. And I always – the number one thing I would constantly hear you know, by people who didn't like Fringe, oh, Anna Torv is a terrible actress. And the thing that I always thought was brilliant is that later on there's a plot where they swap the two Olivias. Like, the Olivia from the alternate universe comes and takes the place of this universe Olivia, and while this universe Olivia is being held in the alternate universe. And you can tell, you can absolutely tell which Olivia she is just by her facial expression. You know, it's uncanny. I mean, I can look at a picture. I don't even have to see them walk. I can look at a picture of Olivia and just tell by the smile which one it is. And I thought that was just a real credit to her as an actress.
Well, let's not forget, she also has a third side where she spends her whole episode doing a Leonard Nimoy impression.
Oh yeah, that one. Yeah.
Because obviously Leonard Nimoy, I mean, just minor spoilers here. I mean, Leonard Nimoy is essentially a former partner of Walter. And he heads up this massive corporation called Massive Dynamic, I believe.
Massive Dynamic, yeah.
Who are, they're kind of like the smoking man of Fringe. They're in the background, they're pulling the strings of different projects, and you're never sure where they... whose side they're on in the greater sort of scheme of things. They're always this presence there, and you're not sure they're an evil presence or they're sort of like this middle ground in this greater scheme of things. But William Bell, who's the head of this corporation, and there's an episode where his spirit is apparently in Olivia's body, so she spends her episode doing a Leonard Nimoy impression, which I have to say, she's you can't say someone's a crap actress and make that work.
No.
But yeah, I mean, I always liked Fringe. It was different enough to not feel like an X-Files rip.
Yeah.
Same way that Millennium was different enough to not just feel like I was just watching The X-Files with Lance Hendrickson.
Yeah.
And I think that's the great thing. I mean, the lens flare that J.J. Abrams throws into his episodes, though, is... I mean, now it's been highlighted to me. I never noticed it back when the show was originally airing, but God, it's annoying now.
Yeah, it's very much... And this is it's very much a product of its time. You know, this ran from, if I recall correctly, it ran from like 2007 to 2012, 2008. Like I said, ran for four seasons, and then an abbreviated fifth season. And this was, I think, really kind of the time when, and J.J. Abrams really was one of the showrunners who kind of spearheaded this, bringing HBO. We were having a discussion before we were recording about kind of how, like, the way somebody shot, how a television show was shot, how that changed so much as a result of HBO kind of coming in and kind of changing the way they did dramas. They did their drama shows instead of, you know, moving away from the way they would do stuff like Tanner and First and Ten, and creating a very cinematic style of episode direction in stuff like Oz and Deadwood and The Sopranos, really kind of to the point where you were then getting, we were, again, this is something we're talking about with, you know, people who were film directors and film actors coming and doing TV and bringing that. And J.J. Abrams, again, starting with stuff like, you know, Alias, which is very shot, I thought, in a very cinematic style, edited in a very cinematic style. And one of the things that I really noticed in particular with this, with Fringe, and it's very fresh in my mind because we just did The X-Files earlier on this year. We had the 11th and hopefully final season of The X-Files, and how The X-Files now kind of, which was so, looked so vital at the time, now looks kind of stodgy because there's, even though there were the new episodes, you know, they were for the most part not being directed by, they were being directed by the writers, and they didn't kind of have the, you know, they didn't really kind of feel like the way these Fringe episodes, the Fringe feels very cinematic. You look at the people, you look at, I mean, this was an episode, it was co-written by Abrams and a guy named Akiva Goldsman. And Akiva Goldsman tends, I think, a little bit unfairly to get a bad rap because he's the guy that wrote the Lost in Space movie from the 90s, and he's the guy that wrote Batman Forever, or Batman and Robin. But he was also Ron Howard's pet screenwriter, and he also directed. And he comes from a very, this was like, I think, the first thing that he'd done in a while that had been on TV, and he brings this very cinematic kind of sensibility to the whole thing. Cinema. I'm sure there was a point to what I was saying. I'm sure that I just didn't kind of like that I intended to take it somewhere instead of just follow the tangent and then stop abruptly. But
Yeah, definitely. I mean, J.J. Abrams, I mean, he's obviously a big name Hollywood director now. But there were shows he was directing, they were falling into that same category of, as I said, it was like around the early sort of 90s where we saw things like, we saw ER, we saw Michael Crichton's like 2-hour pilot for ER, and it felt more like a movie than a TV show. And then it obviously led on to things you said already, when we like The Sopranos and more Keeley 24, which I was always said is like the main one which sort of broke the curse of working in television. Because obviously we have Kiefer Sutherland. Kiefer Sutherland's a movie actor, but yet he's here playing a TV role in a series which feels like a movie just spread over a large canvas. And I mean, obviously you've got things, then you've got like Sopranos, which has got James Gandolfini. You've got Alan Ball, who comes along and does 6 Feet Under. After, I mean, that's fresh off doing American Beauty. And Fringe fell very much into the sort of, as the sort of wave went down of those initial projects, it still maintained that sort of style, because obviously when X-Files came out, it was sort of around the same sort of type of VR. So while it was still obviously being treated as like this big experience show and having like ongoing complex seasons and multiple sort of plot lines and things. Fringe was obviously had the benefit of coming in the wake of these shows which HBO were obviously producing and proving their audience were able to follow multiple characters and complex ongoing storylines, that you didn't have to dumb it down because you're working on TV. You can tell the same sort of quality stories that you would tell on in cinema, but obviously enjoy this larger canvas that TV provides for things.
Right. I mean, X-Files to me always, X-Files always felt its visual sense, which was very in keeping with the time, felt very much like an extension of Twin Peaks. It really did feel like the directors, the key directors, they were bringing the same sort of Rob Bowman, David Nutter, Kim Manners, Bob Goodwin, were bringing the same sort of sensibility that they were basically trying to do, that the people that came after and that directed Twin Peaks after David Lynch were bringing that to the X-Files. And also I think a good share of like what Jonathan Demme brought to Silence of the Lambs, but it just like watching kind of like the progression of how TV drama looks. You know, Twin Peaks was probably the first big, you know, instance of somebody who was a film person coming to TV and bringing a sensibility to TV. But again, looking at old Twin Peaks, I still think still looks like a TV show, you know, even though it has, you know, these yeah. precursors. And that really is kind of like the first, you know, instance of one of the first instances you have. I mean, it was produced by and you know, at why it took the executives so long to figure this out, that audiences could follow a large cast, they could follow ongoing plot lines, because that is what soap operas have been doing for years. You know, I assume, I know that there are major differences between our soap operas and your soap operas, but I'm still pretty sure that when you the basic idea of serial storytelling with a large canvas of characters still, I think, kind of looks the same, kind of is the same, whether you're talking about EastEnders or Coronation Street or General Hospital.
Yeah. Oh, definitely so. And I think one of the things I loved about Fringe is it evolved very naturally, much like The X-Files. The X-Files, I mean, when it starts, is basically Kolchak, the Night Stalker.
Right.
But with FBI agents. And, I mean, obviously X-Files evolves into this global conspiracy and has all these, like, players in, like, the highest areas of government, and it was able to balance like Monster of the Week stories with this much larger conspiracy, and seeing these characters go on their own, this little odyssey to search for the truth.
Right.
And obviously Fringe did the same. It started off as, oh, we'll just investigate fringe science, we'll investigate strange occurrences, and then suddenly we're like, no, these are all, this is just the tip of the iceberg here.
Right.
These are all like the things, and what, as we get closer to find out what's going on, we find out, no, these are all coming through from an alternate dimension.
Right.
So now we're bringing in, like, alternate dimensions, and we've got massive politics here. We've got, like, the things we're doing in our dimension are affecting things in Dimension B, and they're right. not happy about it, so...
It's not like a complete click moment like it is in the X-Files, where you're sitting around, you're watching the X-Files, and you're watching this, and you're watching that, and okay, and then you just, you know, you get to the end of season one, and it's the Erlenmeyer flask, and everything clicks into place. You know, I mean, I just rewatched the Erlenmeyer flask recently, and I was just amazed by how, you know, just like how that much, you know, how kind of like, oh yes, now everything is kind of clicked into place for this, and I see how this is going to go forward. It's not one moment like that. It's like a number of things, like particularly the season later on in season two, an episode called White Tulip with Peter Weller, RoboCop. Probably the best episode of the show. And just, this is what the show is going to be. This is what we're going to, this is where we're going. And that is, I think, kind of like a glorious moment when you figure out that when you realize that Fringe has figured out what it's going to be, what it's going to do, and what kind of stories it can tell. And it's not like anything. I don't think I've ever seen any show quite like it, and I don't think I've ever seen any show quite like it since. There's there's obviously bits and pieces of, you see the kind of like the various influences, not just always the influences that Abrams brings. I mean, obviously it's got the Altered States influence, which is where Blair Brown comes from, the Twilight Zone influence, the X-Files influence, the Twin Peaks. Again, it's really hard to get away from Twin Peaks. There's a later episode that's even called Northwest Passage. The apocryphal name of the Twin Peaks pilot. But this is kind of the point where you realize you're watching something that it's Rick and Morty is very similar in that style, where it's like there's a point in Rick and Morty where you're seeing things. It kind of looks like this. It kind of looks like that. It kind of looks like Doctor Who. It kind of looks like this. It kind of looks like, you know, it kind of looks like it's playing on Back to the Future. But all of a sudden you realize it's a completely own thing and you've never seen anything like it.
Yeah,
that is, I think, an amazing thing, and that I think is why Fringe really is probably one of my favorite shows of the last, well, ever. But I really do think that it was probably my favorite science fiction show, really, before of the new millennium, before Rick and Morty came along. Just because I think it's just so wild and it goes off and. It does so many interesting things, and it was always unfair that people would just look at it and say, "Yeah, weird stories and FBI agent." Oh, it's the X-Files.
I think that's the thing. Whenever we have anything that's familiar to ourselves, we're always like, "Oh, it's just this." But
yeah,
I mean, just to repeat that soul crushing first lesson you learn in writing class: there are no original stories.
Right.
They're only concepts, and you rework them. And the only when you create a story, you're finding a unique spin on a story that's already been told. There are only any story that you can tell has been told before. It's about how you're going to spin it and the direction you're going to bring. So, yes, we're talking about government agents investigating weird things. Yes, that's like X-Files. X-Files is essentially, you know, weird things being investigated. Oh, that's like Kolchak. So if we're just obviously comparing Fringe and X-Files, they're different enough, and I mean, it outlines in its own title sequence what Fringe focuses on, because it outlines all the things that Fringe likes to interest itself with, and you can see straight from like genetics and alternate dimensions, all these little buzzwords that it throws up in its credit sequence. It's a lot of like saying, you know, we may look like X-Files, but, you know, we're going this way, they're going that way. And this is how we differ. And I think it's that crossroad, that just slight difference there, which makes it such an enjoyable show, rather than thinking, oh, I'm just watching a reworking of a concept which has been proven to work.
Right.
Yeah, so that's... I think that's all I have to... Without...
Fringe.
Get into like major spoilers and that, but yeah, definitely Fringe. Recommend it. Go check it out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, definitely.
We're gonna take a quick break now. When we return, though, we will be getting into our second selection of the evening as we look at British health and safety films with the classic Apaches.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at thatmomentin.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we're going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site thatmomentin.com, or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it.
And we're back. You, of course, are still listening to TV Good Sleep Bad. If you haven't done already, you know, please do help support the show by clicking the like and subscribe button. You can also get in touch with us via Facebook or Twitter. Or you can either leave us a message in the comment section below if you're listening to us via our home base, thatmomentin.com, or Podomatic, or iTunes. You know, all feedback is welcome and appreciated, and certainly helps the show grow. We obviously looked at in the first half Fringe, and in the second half now we are going to be looking at the public information film Apaches in a slight change of pace. But the reason I'm choosing to look at Apaches is because growing up in England, the public information films were often shown during any of your sort of weekend afternoon viewing, and more often than not during your post-school kids TV viewing. They would drop these public safety films in, and you would also be showing them at school, and basically the whole point was just to traumatize you against doing anything, be it going on building sites or, you know, electricity, or talking to strangers, or talking to other children, or going near a railway line. So it does seem, there
or,
seem to
or
be
really
a
just program. Anything other than staying hiding in your room, basically.
Yeah.
Like.
That's basically what the government wants you to do. You just stay in your room and don't do anything. Do not interact with anything, because the world is a scary and dangerous place. And this is how we were kept safe as kids, by just having these traumatizing films shown to us. Apaches was released back in 1977, and it's a public information film about farm safety. Now, the film itself was directed by John McKenzie, who is probably best known as the director of The Long Good Friday. And the film itself follows a group of kids who are playing as Indians on this farm, and over the course of the film suffer a number of horrible farm-related accidents as their number is slowly whittled down. All the while this being set against the backdrop of a wake. Now, Lucky, I know you're obviously a...
Hello?
Yeah, sorry, I'm just... One of my kids is away, but I'm just making sure he's the eldest one, so he's fine. He's just going to the bathroom, yeah, sort himself out.
Come to play with some farm implements.
Yeah.
God, I'd be a horrible parent.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, you yourself are a self-confessed Anglophile, and I'm right in saying you never heard of this film, because this film wasn't actually made it over to the States, because this was a British thing, so...
You know, we didn't have things like this. Those of us who are into kind of like, I guess the esoterica of other Commonwealth-derived... other places that started off as colonies from the motherland, shall we say, are... you know, those of us who are kind of like into the kind of like the cult, like just the weird little nooks and crannies of, I think we've always been in kind of awe of the public safety films of Great Britain and Australia. We didn't have anything like this. We'd be shown these film strips, and we'd be told about safety, and you would have these things on commercial television. You know, where we would have, icons like, you know, cartoon icons like Smokey the Bear, and he would tell you not to start forest fires, or, you know, we would have, you know, the Ad Council, you know, with Dick Van Dyke, who we found out later was completely and utterly drunk off his ass when he recorded these things, you know, telling us, you know, how to, you know, deal with bullies and not to stick things in your ear and puncture your eardrum. But we didn't have like these short films professionally made, professionally written. I mean, the thing is that you talk about how the framing device is awake, but you don't realize it's awake until much later in the film. You know, it's only about, and this is like a 25-minute long film, and yeah. You don't realize until you're at, I mean, it dawned on me at two-thirds of the way in the film. It's like, this is a wake for one of the kids that's dead, isn't it? You know, this is a funeral. This is the party or the little gathering that comes afterwards. That's when it hit me. But the thing is about this is that... What really struck me about it is that I've heard that there is that these are basically kind of like practically considered their own little subset of horror films of the British culture, that they have this kind of reputation that's similar to, say, like the, you know, that this It's like, again, like another subgenre, practically. You know, and I'd always heard about, I hadn't heard of this one, but I'd heard of things like Protect and Survive and a couple of other ones, and When the Wind Blows, which is about the effects of nuclear war. And that one I've actually seen because it, pardon me, because it had a soundtrack by Roger Waters, and it was released by, during my, during the height of my Pink Floyd obsession.
Yeah, I mean, When the Wind Blows isn't a traditional public safety film. I mean, it's just a, it's based on the graphic novel by the guy who did The Snowman. And much like The Dark Crystal, your parents think, oh, you know, Raymond Briggs, he did The Snowman. And, you know, we'll watch As the Wind Blows. You know, that's a nice, innocent title. No, it's about two old people who survive nuclear fallout and then succumb to radiation poisoning.
It's one of these, I guess it has pretty much kind of like the same sort of, people would respond the same way. It's like, oh, yeah, Studio Ghibli, these are the same people that made Spirited Away and... Princess Mononoke. Sure, let's let our kids see Grave of the Fireflies.
It's the same. It's like, he's like, oh, Dark Crystal. You know, that's by that Jim Henson fellow. He did the Muppets.
Muppets. And it's like, you wonder why your kid doesn't talk to you for the next year.
And you know, I mean, this is the thing. It's why Xenials grow up as tough as we are compared to Millennials, because we're traumatized.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, what I was, to get back to what I kind of got off on a tangent, what I wasn't expecting was for this to look so much, I was expecting this to look cheesy. I was expecting to have this to have the production values of a Doctor Who episode. this is a proper short film. You know, I mean, they're not the best child performers in the world. But they're pretty credible in their roles. That there is the big gaping plot hole of considering that two of these deaths seem to happen on the same farm at the same day. and the first one is actually witnessed by an adult. How is it that the five out of six kids are able to die over the course of 25 minutes just by being idiots in a farm? I mean, how are they able to continue past that first one? I mean, that's just the biggest plot. That was the thing I kept thinking. That's a gigantic plot hole. But other than that, I mean, it's structured like a proper drama. It's filmed, you know, it's not filmed by a slumming industrial, you know, some guy who makes industrial training films. I mean, it's done by the guy who did The Long Good Friday. I mean, it's effective. I mean, the first scene, I mean, the first kill, I cracked up because I was not expecting it to look like the late 70s British short film equivalent of Final Destination.
It pretty much is. I mean, we obviously open to these kids, and they're playing Indians, and they go on this farm, and one of them jumps on this tractor trailer, and I love the fact that the farmer gives zero shits about this kid being on the back of his trailer. He's there doing finger guns at this kid, who's riding on the back of the tractor.
By the way, want to say call back to that one Spaced episode we watched,
and you know. Oh, unsurprisingly, the kid falls off the tractor and gets run over. You know, that's... We're then cut to the teacher removing the child's name off their peg at school.
There's a little streak of blood, and the plastic gun snapped in half. But this is not a picture that's... I mean... It's heavy-handed in its lesson, but in another way, it's not talking down to the kid. It's these are proper dramatic techniques.
Yeah, I mean, these films, they didn't, while the subject matter, it seemed incredibly gory and violent, they really worked off the power of suggestion. They would, like, cut things right to the bone. There's another one about railway safety where a kid loses both his legs because he gets hit by a train while trying to get his football boots, which are stuck in the rail. And they cut it right to the thing. And it's like next scene, it's like, oh, the kid's been lifted into his wheelchair, but clearly he's got no legs anymore. Uh-huh. But you don't see it, but, you know, in your mind, you've seen it.
Right.
Obviously, we obviously have this scene, and there's a little more of a plot going on. Next day, kids back at the farm. You know, not enough one of their friends has just died, but they're now playing hide and seek and kick the can. And another child falls into a slurry pit, which is basically a pit of pig poo and other animal waste, and drowns. So I think this is only the second time I've seen someone die in a slurry pit. The other being in Slaughter High. There's a link for you.
Drowned in liquid shit, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, it's a real poopality. This one you do see some kid drown in poo.
Yeah, Americans have more of an idea of the sanctity of childhood, I think. Than I think the British do. Mm. You know, even going to, I mean, you look at kind of the fiction that I grew up on, you know, I mean, as a kid, I would read stuff like you would read stuff like Shel Silverstein, and you would read Norton Justman's Phantom Tollbooth, and then you would go, and then I would move on to that from that to a Roald Dahl book like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and that's torture porn, basically.
Mm.
You know, I mean the idea of that, particularly as applied to the original film version with Gene Wilder, the idea that Charlie and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is a horror film in disguise has been posited and done to death. But it is really, you know, when you talk about that sort of thing, that is not something you see a whole lot of. And I mean, these are things that the point of, you know, these events is to present moral lessons in a very visceral way, going in the tradition, at least going back to Kipling and the Just So stories, you know, going to, you know, this is, we're going to tell you a tale of what will happen to you if you are bad, you know, or if you're not careful, if you're not mindful, if you're not good, and it's not going to be pretty. Yeah. You know, we're not gonna sugarcoat it. You're gonna be in a lot of pain, and you're gonna be deformed. You're gonna lose limbs. You're gonna fucking die. And you know, I mean, when the Harry Potter books came over here and became a sensation over here, I think part of the reason they became sensation over here was because that's not what literature aimed at. That, I mean, yes, there is dark American young adult literature, and there was before Harry Potter came along, but that you hadn't seen stuff like that worked on such a visceral level, that had such a tendency towards violence, you know, and in its own way, you didn't have that thing really kind of directed or marketed at a audience that young before. You know, the thing I always tell people to kind of remember why America is so damn wacky is that really we are, you know, this is always kind of struck in as we are a very puritanical culture. We are a very puritanical culture that really doesn't, I mean, the English have a reputation for being stuffy and reserved, but we have this whole, we take it in many ways to a whole nother level where we're just so squeamish about everything, you know, and it's always kind of, I always find it fascinating what you can get away with over here and you can get away with in Britain, you know, where over here you can get away with gory films to a much lesser extent than you can in Britain, where you had in the 80s, you had the video nasties list on the other hand. But on the other hand, I don't think an American could ever, I don't think an American ever could have written and published and turned the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory into a phenomenon. Or I don't think in America we never would have done something like these public information films.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mention, obviously, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, because Roald Dahl openly hated kids.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
why his and books so... are full of, like, horrible things happening to children.
Oh, yeah.
It always amused me the fact that he's this popular children's author who doesn't like kids. The funny thing is with these public safety films, they're not viewed in censorship terms the same as, like, the video nasties. So what we see have things like... the BBFC are banning films based on their own personal preferences of, like, James Furman, the head of the board at the time, and people like Mary Whitehouse, these, like, puritanical forces that are just, like, trying to keep us on the straight and narrow. Public information films don't fall under this because, you know, they're there to serve a purpose. They're there to educate, so they fall under the educational bracket, which means they're censored differently. So you would see some
part of the whole keeping on the straight and narrow thing.
Exactly. And you know? This is why these films are so horrific as they are. And I mean, we were only two deaths into this one, and by the third death, I mean, these kids are still back on the farm, and now they're passing around the poison. Because they've decided they're going to pretend to drink poison, drink from this bottle, the same
White
way
Man's
we did in the
fire water. Yeah, they're pretending it's moonshine, and one of the fool kids actually drinks and drinks it instead of pretending to drink it.
Yeah, I love it. It's the fact it's the kid who comes up with the idea to pretend to drink who accidentally drinks the poison.
Yeah.
So, you know, she spits out, and you think, oh, you know, she's fine. Nope. Middle of the night, she wakes up excruciating pain.
Oh my god!
It's haunting because you're watching the outside of the house. You see the light come on, and you're hearing this child screaming, and it is absolutely haunting. And she cops it as well. I'm putting a light spin on this just to try and keep this light because this is really dark for 25 minutes. We cut to the mother emptying the child's bedroom. And this is a really nice cut here because we cut to Danny, who's like one of the kids, he's narrating the party scene that ties all that goes in between this. And he doesn't understand why adults drink, and the parents are pouring whiskey from a bottle identical to the one we saw with the chemicals in it.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
So that's a really cool cut. And I mean,
I remember even thinking it's like... It's like it's like the grown-up parties are bad. Nobody gets any presents. Nobody gets any games. They just stand around and drink. They drink because they have to be your parents, you idiot.
Yeah, and
because you're dropping like flies.
So you know, three kids down, and what do the kids do? Oh, they're back on the farm again, and now they've decided that they're done playing Indian, so they're going to play Starsky and Hutch instead.
The thing that really dates this to 1977. And I was impressed. I was impressed that the kids knew that Hutch was short for Hutchinson, which it literally took me into my 20s to figure out.
So we get a little bit of a false tease here because we think a child's going to get run over by a tractor, but he doesn't. Instead, he gets crushed by a gate that he dislodges. And this is the full body dummy they use here. And if I'm from the looks of it, it looks like it was a full body with Sussy Andy doll that they used here, because it's a very realistic doll that they crush under this gate.
Let's put it like this. For a split second, I actually thought it was the child actor. That's how good your CPR dummies are. Our CPR dummies, they look like plastic storefront mannequins.
Oh yeah, we've got like the torso, uh-huh. which is a more common one, but they do a full body one, which they use for various purposes, not just like CPR training. And I haven't seen one in a long time, so whether they still have them or not, but it did look very similar to the one they had here, especially because of the head. So if they just like stuff something full of paper or something, their head wouldn't be looked as realistic as this body looks. So it's a really effective scene to see this child crushed by a gate. So far we've learned, you know, don't mess around on tractors, don't mess around in slurry pits, drink poison, or mess around with gates. So, four very important lessons there. And so, of course, what are the kids? Yeah, they're back on the farm. And this time it's Danny's turn. He notices a tractor that's been abandoned by the farmer, and he decides he's going to hop on and go for a ride. And oh no, it's out of control and heading towards the ditch. Very, very slowly heading to a ditch. And you, at this point, you're thinking, you know, why didn't he just jump off? But no, he holds on and goes right over the ditch with it. So,
I like how he calls for help. And the two adults stare at him for a good 30 seconds before leaping into action.
It's like, oh.
I really think that the thing that this film proves is that British parenting is for shit. Because they live on a farm, and these kids are just basically, they're dropping like flies. You know, they're dying at a quicker rate than teenagers having sex in a Friday the 13th movie, and their parents, who are still around. It's hilarious, because and this is the whole thing. For like the last 5 minutes, you know, the whole thing leading up to Danny's death on the tractor, we actually cut the other surviving kid out of the story, and we entirely focus on Danny and Danny's internal monologue. And he's going over this Cowboys and Indians style, you know, monologue in his head. You know, we get to, I mean, again, very cinematic, you know, and we get this whole thing. We spend like the last 5 minutes, and he asks the guy on the tractor if he can get on the tractor. And the guy lets him and then walks away.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know about Britain, but I would think about three after three deaths. I think that the parents of these kids would sue whoever owns the farm into oblivion. If this was if they were Americans, I don't know, because we're a very litigious nation. You know?
Yeah.
I'm just absolutely amazed that this sort of thing can just keep happening and happening. And I understand that it's part of the, you know, and I probably wouldn't have noticed it if I'd been like the target audience, you know, for this, that I wouldn't have, but it just does kind of strike me that this is, as much as this is a film about kids not being cautious, this is really a film about the perils of lax parenting, you know. And the joke is, I made the joke about, yeah, they drink because they have to raise you, and it's, no, they drink because they're to erase the guilt that their negligent parenting has killed 5 out of 6 kids.
So, so obviously Danny, who's been our ghostly narrator the whole time, because here's the kicker, the party we've been watching is actually his wake, and Michael, the surviving child, is revealed to be Danny's cousin, and Danny, as I said, a narrator, his final thoughts is that he wishes he could have gone to the party, which is obviously he wishes he could was at his own wake.
And I love, again, a very nice touch here. The way they add a little bit of reverb to his voice at the end of his monologue. I wish I was there, honest. They just twist the knife. Yeah, he's dead. This is an otherworldly voice. He's speaking from beyond the grave. You can tell because of the reverb. You know, that's a subtle cue. That's a subtle, you know, cinematic device, a subtle sounding device that they're going to use in a grammar, you know, in a sound grammar way to say, this is what it sounds, this is what your sound voice will sound like when you're dead.
So, if the chat that we've had, what, 5 kids die in farm accidents over the course of this movie is not enough, they really drive it home over the closing credits, so they give a list of real children who died in actual farm accidents in the year leading up to the film being made.
Names so, and ages.
Yeah, so
names
it's...
Names and ages.
It really drives it home. And at this point, as a child, and even mind as an adult, because this is shocking as an adult, as a child, you were normally with that same shocked expression that the kid in Black Books has after Bernard Black took a dump in the laundry basket. And as adults, you would be exposed to these films, and you'd be there like just twitching in this shock state, and And normally your teachers are like, oh yeah, they're fine. They look shocked and they look surprised. All kids look surprised. But yeah, you used to watch this. This used to be like an assembly. You used to get to watch these films about railway safety. And I mean, I grew up in Cornwall, which is all farmland and beach. So with, you know, dangers around every corner where we are. And so it was very potent to have farm safety videos. And
isn't Beachy Head in Cornwall?
Yes, I believe it is.
Yeah, the famous suicide cliffs.
Yeah. There's people falling off cliffs all over the place around there. There's a particular. It's not like we have one particular set of cliffs. I mean, you find a cliff, someone's falling off it around there.
Yeah, but the one that I always hear about associated with suicide is Beachy Head.
So yeah, I mean, there's a whole host of these films out there, and a lot of them are endorsed by various celebrities. Quite shockingly, a number of celebrities who've more recently been indicted on child abuse charges, such as Rolf Harris, Gary Glitter.
Jimmy Savile teaches you about farm safety.
Oh, Jimmy Savile taught you about belt safety, so why you got a clink clunk when you wear your belt in the car. But now I've got some DVDs of these collections they released to us. It's all like a novelty thing for people like myself who like watching public safety films. And myself and my wife, we like to joke. It's all like, oh, watch out for Jimmy. If you don't put your belt on, Jimmy will come for you. I mean, the host of celebrities that did these, I mean, I sent you before, we had Donald Pleasance did one about water safety where he plays deaf. He voices deaf really ominously.
I know John Pertwee did at least one.
Yeah, John Pertwee teaches about road safety with Splink. We had Darth Vader himself was the Green Cross Code Man.
Dave Prowse.
Yeah. It's quite amazing the people that they had to do these films. And yeah, I mean, this one is very similar. There's another film, which is an American film called One Got Fat, which is about bicycle safety. And in it, a number of you see these kids running down the road and they're wearing these creepy ass monkey masks. And basically, they over the course of the film, they suffer accidents. And the kicker being that the one child who did follow all the bike safety rules got to have all their lunches. So hence he became the one that got fat.
That is, particularly the monkey masks, that really is, I think, quintessentially American.
You watch it, it's like some creepy pasta nonsense. It is. I'll throw the links up on down below so you can all check those out for yourselves. More recently, there is an Australian anti-truancy film that came out, and it's called Set Yourself Free. And basically, it opens, you got the young girl, and, you know, she's like a real Dawson's Creek style teen. She's decided she's going to skip out on school, and she's going to go and hang out with the boyfriend and her other friends. They're going to go down to the beach and whatnot. And it's all, as I said, it's all very OC. It's all slow motion and running through the waves, and everyone's having a good time. And then suddenly one of them blows up because they stood on a landmine. Because the kids have walked onto a beach which has landmines.
Oh, and, God. Oh, God.
Oh, this one's really full on.
It's oh, my God.
And
oh, my God. Are there still beaches in Australia? Are there beaches in Australia with landmines on them?
Apparently, this is like a beach that's used for military training or something. But okay. It's sort of like, this is about stay in school. Wow.
I was just wondering if there was a point when the Japanese, and maybe like World War II, the Japanese might have actually landed on Australian beaches and mined Australian beaches, and there's still unexploded ordnance from like the 40s. This is something that Paul McCartney should show up and talk about.
Oh, I mean, there's whole military grounds like on the moors and stuff where there's like unexploded shells and stuff. There's like... every few months you have some child who's been up on the moors and walked into school with like a grenade or something they found on the moors. So like the local bomb squad has to come out to disarm it. The American ones, there is another one called Will You Be Here Tomorrow, which has got a lot of coverage on the internet. And again, that's one about safety in the workplace, and it features people being horribly maimed in horrible, horrible ways. I mean, crushed in compactors and
that one I've heard of.
Yeah, that's a fun one to watch if you're on a cool kick. But yeah, I think certainly with the British ones, there's one about talking to strangers, and as the classic line, it's like, "Oh, look at this man, he's a wrong'un."
He's a wrong'un.
And it's
God.
And it's all like, you can't tell with these people that they don't look like monsters. And it shows this creepy pedophile guy, and it like shows him switching between these different sort of creepy guises of people he could be. And they don't talk to strangers film that they put out. Again, that was another one we saw in school.
Oh, God.
And I remember one year the British Rail decided they were going to replace the video of the kid having his legs cut off. And they brought out a different one, and the opening has a kid being crushed between two train trucks. And it got to the end of the video, and we all complained the fact that we weren't shown the one with the kid losing his legs.
Wow.
So, yeah, the British Rail's attempts to lighten the trauma didn't play out too well, as bloodthirsty kids all wanted to watch the other one.
You were traumatized, but you were also titillated. Once you've been given a taste of the real stuff, you could never go back.
It's kind of like...
It's like cannibalism.
It's kind of like once watching a horror film, sweet, but
sweet,
safe.
It's like that. Once you get a taste of that sweet, sweet human meat, nothing else will just satiate your hunger.
Yeah. I mean, you have to remember, the kids at this level, we're exposed to things like the witches, which is horrific when you have like the transformation scene in the witches, and you've got Angelica Houston taking off her false prosthetics and stuff.
Uh-huh.
That was traumatizing as a kid. So this was on that same sort of level when you were... these films were deemed as okay to show in between your cartoons, like, don't play at the power station, don't play on pylons. And if you weren't shown these films, you were told these cautionary tales about kids who tried to climb over electricity pylons and burst into flame. And
God, Johnny, and here's a little video for you. Rolf Harris wants to talk to you about spontaneous human combustion.
Rolf Harris wants to talk to you about talking to strangers.
Oh, Christ.
Oh,
God. Oh, my God.
But, you can watch Apaches on YouTube. It is available on there. There are many of the health and safety films are widely available because they are pretty much in the public domain, so you can watch them on YouTube or wherever you like to watch things. And, yes, they are a little dated, but there's a real effectiveness to these films already.
I'm sitting here, I'm making fun of Apaches. But on the other hand, it is an amazingly effective short horror film.
Do you think you're going to be able to go to the farm and not act the fool now?
Oh God, no! I'm gonna get up on a tractor and wave a plastic gun around. That's what I'm gonna do.
So
I'm gonna jump and drown myself in a pit of pig shit.
Poopality.
Poopality! Finish him!
So, that's my colourful pick for this episode. I hope you've obviously enjoyed this little journey into the realm of British health and safety. There are other ones, and I feel that we may revisit some more as we go down. So if you've obviously got a favourite public safety film that you'd like to see us discuss, please do let us know in the comments section, and we will certainly see if we can get it dug out and expose Lackey to it, because as I said, we're just touching the surface of these films. There's so many different aspects that they want us to be safe about here in the UK. So
if you like Scarfall, you'll like British public safety films.
Oh boy. Well, I mean, that brings us to the end of another episode of TV Good Sleep Bad. Thank you, as always, for listening. Before we obviously wrap up, I mean, Lucky, what would you like to look at on the next episode?
I hadn't had one planned, so I'm just going to go with the first one that comes to mind, which is the second episode of the first season of Inside Number 9, a show written by and starring Reese Shearsmith and Steve Pemberton of the lead of Gentlemen. It's going to be the second episode of the first series. Like I said, the name of the episode, I believe, is Quiet Night In, and it co-stars Una Chaplin from Game of Thrones and Dennis Lawson, who everybody knows as Wedge from the Star Wars films.
Cool. For myself, I'm going to take us back to one of a classic cartoon of the 90s, which has recently been rebooted through Hulu. We're going to look at episodes 2 and 3 of Animaniacs.
Ooh.
This is obviously a cartoon show produced by the WB, and it's one which, watching as an adult, you realize how sharp the writing on the show was, and certainly, more interestingly, what they managed to slip past the censors. And the reason I'm saying we're going to do episodes 2 and 3 is just purely just because there's certain characters that appear on one episode that don't appear on the other, and there's certain key sort of skits that that appear over the course of these 2 episodes. And as I said, they're 20 minutes each, so it's hardly like a huge amount of your TV viewing time we're going to take over here. But yeah, hopefully you come back to join us for Inside Number 9 and Animaniacs, which we'll be looking at on the next episode. As always, if you haven't done already, please do hit the like, subscribe buttons. If you're on Podomatic or iTunes or listening to us for our home base, thatmomentin.com. We are currently in the process of uploading all our old episodes onto the archive. Most recently, we've got episode where we looked at UFO and Dead Like Me on there. Meanwhile, on the network over on Game Warp, they are looking at The Awesome Adventures of Captain Spirit, the prequel of sorts to the forthcoming Life is Strange 2. Cinema Recall is asking the question of what makes a good film critic, as well as on the Asian Cinema Film Club, they are checking out John Woo's classic, The Killer, starring Chow Yun-fat. So,
hey!
Lots of good stuff to check out on the network, and obviously there's great written stuff on there as well. We've got the Westworld recaps, we've got Zoe Rose Smith, who's looking at very weird cinema, we've got the movie tourist segments, we've got video game reviews, we've got we're looking at scenes within movies. There's all sorts of good stuff on there, so definitely check out thatmomentin.com as well, and show them some love as well. But thank you, as always, to Lucky, for joining me.
Pleasure as always.
And obviously being subjected to this darker side of British cinema.
Hey, any sort of weird nooks and crannies, I'm always kind of catches my interest. I've been meaning to look into some of these for a while anyway.
Cool. And we will, of course, be back soon looking at Inside Number 9 and Animaniacs. But until next time, this is Edward Jones from My News Always. To keep it strange.